following is an unrehearsed interview with Mr. J.B. Johnson by Debbie Wilson for the Kentucky Oral History Commission. The interview was conducted at the home of Mr. Johnson in Williamsburg, Kentucky on July the 19th, 1978 at 10 o'clock a.m. The first thing I want to start with, Mr. Johnson, is just something of your own personal background. Now, what is your full name?
Your name's B. Johnson.
Now, where were you born?
I was born on Meadow Creek. Post office at that time, it's been gone 50 years, was Dishman. Name of a family that had lived, that did live, a prominent family that did live there.
Well, now, when were you born?
April the 10th, 1897.
Who were your parents?
My father was Arby Burgess, A-R-B-Y-B-U-R-G-E-S-S, Johnson. My mother was Cynthia Bryant.
Well, now, where were you educated?
My education for the first several years, till eighth grade, was out in a rural one-room school, one teacher for everybody.
What was your occupation?
We lived on a little farm.
What was your occupation as a man? What did you do for a living?
We plowed and hoed corn and gathered it in, potatoes and things of that kind.
Well, when did you begin your career as a lawyer?
1927, when I began to practice law. Started in law school in 24.
Where did you go to law school at?
University of Kentucky.
How long did you practice law?
I practiced law 52 years.
Who is your wife?
Edna P. Johnson. Perkins. Edna P. Perkins. Edna Perkins is. That P is for Perkins.
How many children did you have?
Three.
Are they still here in Whitley County or have they left?
One of them is here, the youngest one. The daughter, the oldest, is in Lexington. And the second son, the second child, Wesley, is in Ashland, Kentucky.
Well, now I want to move on to the history of Whitley County. I understand that you have some information back to the very earliest years of Whitley County, and that's what I'd like to start with.
Yes.
What do you know of the first settlers who came into Whitley County?
The first that came into Whitley County came in 1869 and 1769 and 70. Along in there during or just before the Revolution, the first ones, their names were Ty, I think he got it in the order, T-Y-E, John Ty family, who lived on the head of Poplar Creek and one of the old Ty houses. I can't say it is the first one, but one of them is still standing and is occupied. I passed by it Sunday. It's in Poplar Creek. That is just across from Hahn's store as you go up 92 toward Pineville, about 12 miles from here, maybe 14. It's this, that a house is still there. They don't live. The Ties are no longer live there. I don't believe there's a Tie in that country now. Yeah, that's the important. Then there was the McVeighs that lived also in the east end of the county. And there at Mossy Gap, that's also right on the same road up the river. And they are another pioneer family. And then there is a house near Corbin. It used to be in the city limits. It is in Corbin, city limits. I may be able to remember the name in a minute, but I thought of it while I was talking with the others, but I've slipped, that name has slipped my mind right off. And it was only torn down. It was a big log house. It was only torn down a few years ago. I've seen those houses, all of them, many times. I understand the McVeigh house is still standing, but is dilapidated and caving in and things of that kind. I haven't been to the house. It's difficult to get to it. It's up on a high point above the Cumberland River. On Poplar Creek, but it runs into the Cumberland River about 4 miles below there. Those are the McVeighs and Ties. And right off, I can't remember the other name. They all continued, that family, they were pioneer families. They all continued to be, in the day, rather progressive people. My people, I guess that's the thing I remember. My people, the Johnson family. There are two Johnson families that some of them located on Meadow Creek. Now, the Johnson, I'm of the Daniel Johnson string. We came here from Virginia. The other Johnson family was what was known as the Buggy Bill Johnson family. He was so big and fat he couldn't ride a horse but had to get a buggy to ride in. They called him Buggy Bill. And I have seen him as a kid. He lived to be a very old man, very large man, driving a buggy. But they both came into Meadow Creek, or married rather, on Meadow Creek. Two different families. They were from North Carolina. I'm related to both families. My great-grandmother was a McCann, and her mother was a sister to, Buggy Bill Johnson's daughter, her mother married Buggy Bill Johnson, and they had 13 children. I just guess I better tell that to begin with. And they lived on Meadow Creek, and they were our closest neighbor. And they had one man by the name of Jim Johnson, one son the name of Jim Johnson, who loved history and the genealogy of families particularly. And they had he had 14 children. Well, he married a Mackie, who was the first cousin of my mother on my mother's side, and Jim Johnson's Jim Johnson's mother and my grandmother were sisters. So you can see that I'm pretty well related to both sides. And as a result, I've been fortunate. I've been exposed to a lot of the Johnson family from the McCann or the North Carolina side and the Virginia side. I'm the Virginia line. They're related because Buggy Jill Johnson had so many children and they married.
Well, now, these early settlers, do you know anything about their trip into Kentucky? Any problems?
I know only in our angle, three brothers first started from Virginia. I can't remember now. I have heard the name many times. Some little creek over in Virginia, and migrated through the gap, of course, only way they could do with carrying the things on horses. There wasn't any road. They used horses to carry things, not, and the women walked and carried things, of course, as they came. And I know that those people came through Cumberland Gap and then down to Brush Creek in Knox County, and two of the boys stopped at in the Brush Creek area, and over one of them, about 4 miles away, one of the two from Brush Creek on Richland Creek in Knox County, and the other one went from Richland Creek over into Laurel. I've never been able to find out which the several Johnsons in Laurel County, but I've never been able to contact one of them. Very well, I've known this, and they're still living. One of them died last week in Knox County. They're pretty well known, an established family. They spread out now to different creeks, you know, and things of that kind, but they're there. The oldest will in Knox County, and it's the original county down here, you know, it, and everything else come from Knox County, cut off from it, Whitby was, in 1818. But the oldest written will and recorded in Knox County is in Will Book 1, or it is actually A instead of 1, in Will Book 1 in Knox County. It's there yet. That was my grandfather Johnson, Daniel Johnson, great, great, great grandfather, Daniel Johnson. It's there, recorded now. It's interesting to read it. And the inventory of his estate. Now, an estate was only the personal property. It didn't include real estate. That was a freehold, what we called in those days. And now, we think of real estate, that's just anything. But it is in a different legal category and goes differently on a death. But it, his estate had so many pot hooks and so many sheep, the things that they had in that day. It's an interesting, I've got, I guess it's in the file box I brought from the office. I've always kept it. I was Commonwealth attorney and circuit judge over there for 12 years. And whenever I'd get a little time that I didn't have to get back home, I'd go in the clerk's office and look at those things and find out. I've got a copy of his will and how he disposed of his property. It's interesting. He didn't have much personal property. Nobody had much personal property. Just a few pot hooks and skillets and very, very crude. But he had considerable land, which was worth 50 cents an acre. River, long bank of Cumberland River. Funny. But they're still up there, some of them. I know where two of them still live. Now, the other Johnson came down to about Bryant's store. That's my grandfather's father. He came down to about Bryant's store about just at the time of the close of the Civil War, and the dominant family over there in that area was Bryant's, and he married Cynthia Bryant, my mother. I don't mean that. Swipe it. He married into the Bryant family that finally produced and got down to my mother, Cynthia Bryant. She was a Bryant, and her people were Warfields, which also quite well known. They lived several miles away. When you had to travel by walking or horseback, it's a long way. It's not way we go now, it's not. I don't think people can understand a society that doesn't have running water and toilets in the inside of their house, that doesn't have roads that you can travel over, that doesn't have electric lights. Such a thing as taking a bath at home was something that occurred on Saturday at our house. Usually we had to go saving on water because water came from a spring, sometimes some distance away. So we had no time for transportation, no telephone. It when you was out in the country, you were out in the country. I don't believe that the modern child that's been used to every luxury. I never saw ice except on the creek when it was frozen over in the wintertime. There was no such a thing as iced tea. We don't know how lucky we are to live in this age. Well, let's see. Now the ones at Poplar Creek, my father and mother married in 1875. Did I say 18? That would be right, wouldn't it? 1875. They lived across the river from each other, Cumberland River, and Cumberland River we had, of course, had canoes to cross the river to go from one community. That's the way we crossed. No bridges. And I don't know how they got acquainted. It's that the river is a pretty good river all through that country down to the mouth of Meadow Creek. But anyway, they crossed the river some way. And he got acquainted with Mama, and they married at the ripe old age of 16 for my father and the ripe old age of 14 for my mother. So you can see that I believe in them getting married young, because my father died when I was a month and a day old. And my mother, she lived at 1849, but she was a widow with two children. And I was reared by my grandparents. Shall I just take that family on up? Yeah. Just
tell me about life with your grandparents, about life with your grandparents,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
It was like that.
My grandfather and grandmother. My grandmother was Julia Ann Sharp. My grandfather was Isaac Johnson. They, in the early days, after they got married, the grandparents, I'm talking about my grandparents now, they ventured west in the covered wagon days. Went to somewhere in Indiana, stayed a year, and came back. As far as I know, never took a venture again. They lived on a little farm a mile off of a trail, even as a path. You could get there by walking or riding a horse. Up a holler on a 60-acre farm. But he was a worker. He was a carpenter. And country was filling up pretty fast, so he had demand for work. They lived there a mile off, out of nowhere, for years, and there they raised seven children. My father was the third child. And when they had a calamity in the family, four of my aunts and uncles, two aunts and two uncles, died with tuberculosis in 10 months. And my father had grandfather had tuberculosis, and he knew it. And he knew that my grandmother couldn't rear us grandchildren. She had four, and the mothers of two of the children had died, and one of the fathers had died, my father. And they were undertaking to started out to raise three different sets of grandchildren, me and my sister, that's out of one family, and a girl out of a Perkins family that my Aunt Ida had buried in the Perkins family, and she died with tuberculosis. And Aunt Ella, she had a girl. So my grandmother had four of us. And he had sense enough to know that that was 3 miles from where we were to the schoolhouse, and through a long wood road, and have to cross the creek or branches 4 or 5 times crisscrossing to get in. And when the water was up, you sometimes couldn't cross them. You'd have to walk foot logs and things of that kind. He knew that that was dangerous. But I heard him. I can remember hearing him talk. Now, Julianne, it's not safe for these children to have to go to school this 3 miles, nearly 3 miles, through the woods, crossing these branches all the time. I'm going to go by. He told her where it was. It belonged to her brother, and he had bought a farm over in Knox County, and he is wanting to sell his home over there. So they bought it. He bought that, and we moved there when I was 7 years old. And there I was reared. I guess that's enough.
Now what happened to you at your grandfather's house? What are some of the experiences you had there?
Well, my experiences were just like any other boy under the same circumstances, but I was the only one that had as adverse, I'd say, as the rest. There on Meadow Creek, house is still standing, just about like it was when I left it in 1917, 51 years ago, isn't it? It just about the same house, looks like about the same house. We had a horse, milk cows, always had hogs, chickens in abundance, geese, ducks. We had all the farm animals that we got. We had the geese for feathers, of course, and the ducks. We had all the farm animals that you needed, sheep. But we had very little acreage. Granddaddy Sharp was very good to it. My grandmother, that's my great-grandfather in Sharp, told her to use anything she wanted and wouldn't be in rent. She was, we cultivated and planted everything there is to eat, and particularly things that you could store through the winter. Potatoes and cabbage and turnips and apples and things of that kind that you could keep. We had an abundance of them through the winter. I never saw a time when we had money. I never saw a time when we didn't have enough to eat. Now my grandmother was managing that, nobody else. She was a good manager and the best woman ever lived. No question about that. I never saw her mad in my life. And we got along just fine. We didn't know we was having a hard time. We burned wood and fire, but we didn't have coal. That was before the days of coal. I can remember when coal first began to be burned, about 19 and, I guess it's about 19 and 12, something like that. But we, in the fall of the year, they'd go out and cut dead trees. Never cut a green tree or a tree that could be used for lumber or anything like that. Cut dead trees and swap work. That's the way we got it done. I learned to saw before I could stand up to a crosscut saw. And we'd swap work. I had a neighbor that was always, and he was very good to us, a man named Dank Bain. And he would come over and, of course, he could do twice as much work as I could, but we'd swap what we call swap work and get up our wood, sack it in racks, and put it, and we'd have it ready for the winter time. Those winters were long and cold, let me tell you. And we lived growing everything we could in summer and putting up as much of that, potatoes, cabbage, turnips, apples, all those things. We had them through the winter when we wanted them. We had them in holes. We had no place. We had no basement or cellar at our place. And we had them in holes out in the garden. We lived on a kind of a little high raise, and it was very easy. And in wintertime, and I'll tell you about the wintertime. In wintertime, when school wasn't going on, my grandmother, I had two uncles and an aunt who become school teachers. My oldest uncle, Truett, he went to law school, and he was just had been admitted to the practice of law at a time when he had developed TB and he died. So he never did practice a case, I don't think, but he died very young. And that way is the way that we got together and lived together. My mother married again and and went to Washington State in 1909. And she took my sister with her. I wouldn't go, I ran off. I was going to stay with my grandmother, and I didn't, and I'm glad I did. And anyway, we'd school was an old type, one room, one teacher school. And I remember the first day I went to school, they told my sister and a neighbor girl there, telling me what I'd have to do, that I'd have to give my name and so forth. And I said, well, I'm not going to do that. And they said, well, will you be? To the teacher, he'd come around with a big book, taking your name. I said, I know. Oh, my sister, a girl, Olive, one, the girl with her, said, I'll do that. He'd come down, they hit the girls into the, three of us were sitting in one seat, this old type. You ever see those old type seats? I guess not. Two set on one seat, and they had a desk in front of them. Well, there's three of us, small, of course. We're just sitting there. And he said, what's your name? And I said nothing. My sister, I guess it was, had told him my name. And then he looked at the next little girl, and her name was Ollie. And he said, what's your name? She just stubbed up, wouldn't say a word. He talked with them, tried to get her to say her name. She wouldn't. And finally I said, it's Ollie. He wrote down Ollie. He said, Ollie, what else? I said, that's all. Everybody laughed, of course.
Pardon me, I'm going to turn the tape over. Yeah. This is side two of an interview with Mr. J.B. Johnson. Now, go ahead. You were speaking about your school days.
Yeah. That day, I learned, had the first recess, and at noon they played just little games, you know. I played with them. And right away, Andrew McKeon was the teacher, and one of the best teachers, rural teachers, there was in the county, anywhere, I'd say. This continued with, and I went the first 3 or 4 years of the whole school, unless it was we had a terrible big branch between us and the school, and when the foot log washed out, you couldn't get to school. But except for that, I went every day. But by the time I got 8 or 10 years of age, not over 10, I had to stay out to work. We had to dig potatoes to take them, we peddled, you know, and things of that kind. And I have to dig potatoes and gather apples and beans or whatever it was. And of course, my grandmother couldn't do all that. She did a lot of it, but she couldn't do it all. So I'd have to stay out a day or two a week to help get those things. We'd send them off. That's the way we got flour and sugar and coffee and things that you could get. In the rural store, you could get, well, those things I've mentioned, salt, flour, sugar, pepper, things that just stable groceries. But you couldn't get anything in the way of clothing except stockings, some kind of underwear I've forgotten. It's very crude, I know. My grandmother made our clothes by cotton and sheep. We had raised cotton and sheep every year. We shared the sheep and cooked as the wheel of the wool. And her, my clothes, my breeches, coat, things of that kind were made by hand. I've gone to sleep a minute time at the hum of the old spinning wheel humming. Have you ever heard one hum?
No.
That little zoo. And I've done it many a time. My grandmother would be walking the floor and I'd go to sleep spinning. We had not a pick the cotton. Now that was an awful mean thing, to pick cotton, old little seed out of that wool, or pick wool. We had to pick the cotton and the pick wool. We was always glad to get that wool and cotton picked. It's hard. Anyway, that's the way they made our clothing. And we later got, when it got a little bigger, had a few more sheep. Why we could swap wool for blankets with the wool buyer. He'd come around and he'd have bolts of goods already woven. We would swap raw wool for that thing. We've done a lot of that, and that's the way we lived. I guess I've said this in repetition. A fellow my age does repeat too much. We never lacked. I never went hungry in my life. But we never had any money. It just didn't exist. We swapped chickens and eggs for most of our vegetables that we had to buy off the flea that we didn't raise. And that way, we were able to have the things. My grandmother was a great cook, and she could cook anything and cook it well. But we were having a hard time and didn't know it. I think of it now, it's a good time. And, let me see where I got to. I stopped. After I was 13 years old, my mother kept writing me and telling me what riches there were in the West. 1913, I went to Rosalia, Washington. That's a little town about 30 miles south of Spokane. And I did a little of everything out there. I was 16 years old. I worked on the farm. That was in the days when they had the combines, 36 horses to pull them and so forth. It's a great experience. I worked on the farm. I worked on the section about 3 weeks. And that's the hardest work anybody ever did.
And what's the section?
Section. That's a railroad divided up, the maintenance of it, they divided into sections. And if you're working on them, tamping ties or putting ties in or whatever it is, you're a section hand. That's what section. And I worked. And then I herded sheep in the Bitterroot Mountains in Idaho. And that's the meanest job, I'd not say the hardest. You darn near freeze to death in that. As the snow melts, it comes down. The sheep graze up, as snow goes off, there's the grass. The sheep like it, it's fresh and green and all. And the snow goes up. And then when you get nearly the top, it begins to get cold again. And as you come back down, you just come down with the melt. And it tops off, or in other words, it gets white and stays on the higher the elevation is. So it just reverses itself. And going up, the snow goes from the bottom on down. And coming back, it comes from the top down. In other words, about 1st of September, you'll start down. I didn't start down. I didn't stay that long. But that's the way it works. That's a great life in many respects. You're out there in the wild with just a couple of dogs and one man. There's two work together. But, oh, it's lonesome out there. You freeze at nighttime. It gets so cold. A kid 16 years old got no business out there, I'll tell you that. Oh, I was with an old-timer that had been in the business 40 years. But he was nice to me. We had it tough. I'm glad I did it, but I sure wouldn't do it again. Yeah. Then I worked after that, I worked in the apple orchards, harvesting wheat, apple orchards, and grocery store in town. Grocery delivered. That was my experience out there. Now, let's say it a little more than a year and a half. My grandmother kept writing me and telling me to come home. And I must say this, I was sending my grandmother some money every month because I knew she needed it, nobody there. And she'd say, son, if you don't get an education, you'll be somebody's slave all your life. You'll be doing what somebody tells you to do. You don't know how that impressed me. And I began to see what it was to be somebody's slave. And I had enough of that. I mean, by mind, I was going to come back to Kentucky and go to school and try to make something out of myself. But there's that repeated thing in a letter. She never wrote me a letter. The last line wasn't, son, if you don't get an education, you're going to be somebody's slave. And I think it's true. Well, let's see. I'm back from the West now. I'm from school here, from Williamsburg. I had an uncle. Now, I'm going to give him all the credit I can. I had an uncle, Dr. Bryant, that practiced medicine on Poplar Creek. And he had a strong influence on me. And he's always telling me that I needed to go to school, get beyond working for somebody for 50 cents a day. That was a prevailing wage until I was 16 or 17, except out west, they paid good wages out there. I got $5 a day out there, many jobs. There's a lot of difference between 50 and 60 cents a day and $5 a day. But he was always urging me to go to school. Dr. Breiter, he said to me, he said, "Now, son," I said, "I know you won't have any money, but," he said, if you'll get ready to go to school, I'll pay your tuition. You won't have to pay it." So I came to Williamsburg after I got out of the eighth grade, and he paid the tuition just like he said he would. It wasn't much, $10 or $15 a semester, and he paid the board cost $10 a month. But now think of it, and he paid my board. And I stayed in Williamsburg out here 2 years. I got enough of what we used to. We could teach on a certificate issued by the superintendent. Didn't have to have so many college units and all that stuff by taking an examination. I took an examination, made a first class certificate. My uncle lived on Poplar Creek. He had quite a bit of a political push. He elected me a superintendent up there. Trustee. The trustee hired the teacher. And I went there and taught in 1917. And that was a great experience. I was up there last Sunday at a homecoming. It hadn't been 61 years since I'd taught school. My son, people that was that size in first or second grade then would come up and see me, and I know you don't know me, and I'm not going to ask you to guess and tell me who they were. I was so glad I went. I saw 35 or 40 that I had known back then. Maybe not hard, 25 maybe. It was such a pleasure. And it was a experience, but I got along just fine. That school had been what they call pretty tough. The tough boys had run off some of the teachers. And I told them the first day they was going to have a job running me off to make up their mind. They never did try it. I'm talking about myself and not county history though now. From there I went into service in 1918. In February 1918 I went into the Marine Corps and then spent 2 years overseas and back home and in school again. That's not a part of the history. That's my history. Let me see. Well, when I came back from the war in 1918, the little community where I had born and reared had bad luck. We had six boys that went overseas and were in service. There was a Barton boy, Doc Barton, there was Henderson, McKinn, and Dave, brothers. There was Lige Cup. There's another. How many have I mentioned there?
That's about four.
Four, yeah. And yeah, that's four. And John Cup and myself, but all went over there. And three of us had been in the same unit, but never did know it. I don't mean the same company, but in the same regiment. And four of them, that four I mentioned, had died. One of them was shot and killed. And John Cup and I, neither one got a scratch. If I know this, I tried to find. I don't think there's any other county, little school district. We all went to school together. And I don't think that's happened to any other school district. It's a remarkable thing. From 1919, when I came home, I went to school again. Over at Richmond that time, a good thing to go, good place to go to. The war was just over. Many of them wasn't even home yet, or were not mustered out of the service. There was 420 enrolled at Eastern at that day. In those days, it was called a normal school then. And there were 20 boys and 400 girls. Now it was a pleasure to go to that school. And I can remember one thing in Whittler County history that perhaps better, and I've told this story more than any other. I wrote a column for the paper here 2 or 3 years. I told this story in that, but it's one morning, it was 1906. I walked out from the front door to the gate to go to school. The Vanderpool, old man Vanderpool, of the very famous 26 children, you heard of him, I guess, came by. He was carrying the mail. My grandmother was giving him a letter to take to the post office. And they stood there and talked for a minute, and while they were there, and just as I got to the gate of the front yard, the most terrible, shocking, earth-quivering blast occurred you ever heard. And they said, "What is that?" Well, they had been building on the Pine Mountain Railroad up to Gatliff and Packard mining camps in this county, about 14 miles east. They had been building a railroad. And they had, during that panic of 1806, they'd had to stop construction of that road, but we'd been hearing they were going to start it up again. We'd been used to blasting when that went on. So he says, "I understand they're going to start up that railroad from Williamsburg to Gatlin and Packard mining camps." And he said, "I guess that's what it is." And my grandmother said, "Yes, I've heard that. That's what it is, I guess." And I turned and walked on to the schoolhouse, wasn't excited about everything. And down there, they were in a cluster. The teacher was there, and they had all agreed that that is what it was, that they'd started that construction again from where it was only about 4 miles from where we were over to the construction, and that they were blasting again. they thought that. It'd been a year since it had any. Went through school, got home that afternoon. The mail carrier had to go to Rockholt to Metro Creek and out to Clate, about a 12-mile one-way trip of a day. So I got home just about the time I got in the yard where I was when I was leaving, and it happened. Old man Vanderpool drove up, rode up. I looked over to my grandmother. She was in the garden doing something. Twice as far from here, that door there, 35 or 40 feet. He said, "Julianne," and she looked up, and she was, I think, digging potatoes, something that she was doing for the garden, a hole. He said, "That big noise we heard this morning was two carloads of dynamite exploded in Jellico and killed everybody in town. And Julianne said, we had a family name of Smith that lived right close to us. She said, Evan and George Smith are there. They had a store. And they were about the same age of her boys. And one of them, Evan, and my Uncle Truett that I told you about, they had been great cronies together. And we said it all was that. But I hadn't much along when the news got in. And a man came by and said, I'm going to Jellico. See, he had some relative that was there. And you could ride through from there to Jellico in 6 hours, I'd say. And several people that had relatives over, Jellico had just recently been built up. Several people had relatives over there. They did it. There's a pretty good bunch of them. Rode into Jellico that night. No telephones in those days. And of course the report was exaggerated. This car did detonate a car dynamite, and there was a turbo hole 25 feet deep. And it did, I reckon there wasn't a house in town that it didn't injure. Destroyed many of them, of course, but it didn't destroy everybody, and it didn't kill everybody. I've forgotten. I think it's 21 that was killed. I've written it, and I'm sure it's 21 that was killed. And nearly everybody was hurt property-wise. I mean buildings and houses. Everybody was hurt. And it took them just a little while, 2 or 3 years, they'd recovered. You couldn't tell it, they said. That is, that tragedy affected more people. Now, every other community had the same thing, because there had been people that had drifted there after the town of Jellico had been developed. There had been little mines stuck up every holler out there, and it had developed, and Jellico had become the shopping center. Not having roads and telephones and things of that kind. And it was a terrible tragedy.
Now I'd like to go back and discuss some things that you've mentioned. You know, when we were first talking about the pioneers, you mentioned that they brought things through the gap with them. Mm-hmm. Do you have any idea of what possessions they would bring in with them?
What they brought with them? Yes, I heard that talk about. They, as foolish as it may sound, they expected to find, and they have been told, that getting food wasn't a problem, because the fish in the river and the wild turkey and bear, deer, and things of that kind that they could kill along the way, and that's what they did. They didn't bring much food, but on the way out, they brought chairs. Not many. They brought a chair. They all figured that they could make chairs, of course. But they brought some chairs. They brought a pretty good supply of bed clothing. And some people had more animal hides than they had woven cloth beds, you know. Animal hides are very comfortable. For bedding and things of that kind. They've always brought with them the kettles and pots to cook in, of course, but not many. They could use heaps of fire and roast things, like apples and potatoes, and, you know, and things that you can roast. They wrote them. They had, of course, traveling that far, traveling as far as they did, anywhere from, they were traveling from 300 to 1,000 miles, depending on where they came from, of course. It is, largely they brought, well, let's say, the three necessities, food, raiment, and clothing. So food and clothing and food and clothing was the main thing they bought. Some brought more than others. Now, my grandmother Warfield, I've seen, it's, I guess it's in some of the family yet. It's been 50 years, more than 50 years since I saw it. I've seen a loom that she brought through the valley. That's unusual for that because it takes a lot of things. Now, she didn't come with the very earliest pioneers. She came sometime right after this Revolutionary War was over. There were several hundred people in the valley when the Revolutionary War, I mean in this valley over beyond the gap, as they said. They was there. She brought I don't know why anybody, it's a great big loom, but they brought it on an ox cart. I've seen it. It's up in Knox County. I've seen it. I guess my eyes were bigger then than they are now. I was new. They always tried to buy, those that had it, and many of them did have, a cow. They liked to bring a cow. Don't need to explain that, do you? All of them were raising families. You don't need to explain that. They brought hogs, horses, of course, they rode and tamed. Guns. All had guns. Some of the women could shoot better than the men.
Pardon me, I'm going to do another take.